That's Anita O'Day from 1958 with Peanut Vendor. She was, of course, a famed big band singer, and Club de Beluga, a hip-hop group, the remix DJ group, just did some justice to that 1958 song. And there you go. We have a wonderful interpretation and a revitalization of Anita O'Day. That's from their 2012 album, The Electro Swing Revolution, Volume 3. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, January the 30th, and it is Free Your Mind Friday right here on this program. And you know what it is. Free Your Mind Friday is an open forum where you can stand on your soapbox and opine away. However, don't be surprised if some people find holes in your argument. It's just their way of freeing their minds. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. And let's hear what you have to say. I'm particularly interested in welcoming new voices here. Getting a lot of feedback from you on Facebook. And, of course, you're writing me at leadstories@gmail.com, so I know what your views are, and I enjoy hearing them, but it would be great to share them with others as well. 888-874-4888. Lots and lots to talk about, I'm sure, so let's get started. From New York, Mitch, you're on the air.
Hello, Lutrice.
Hello.
I enjoy your program, and Happy New Year's to you.
Thank you. Thank you on both counts.
I'd like to bring up something that isn't talked enough about in our community. That's the spelling rate of incarceration among our black people, amongst especially our youth. Although we make up like 13% of the population, 50% of the population is black males and women. And gun violence in our community is at epidemic proportion. And nobody is talking about it, neither the elected officials, those who pretend to be representatives. They don't talk about that, you know, how epidemically this is.
Well, I think people are talking about it, but they're not talking about it from the point of view I'm supposing you want to talk about it. Tell us what you find particularly disturbing about this. Why should this be talked about?
Why should it be talked about? Because we can't have a future if we don't have any youth. with any thought of producing people that can help us out of this mess that we're in.
Well, let's take a look at the statistics you presented. It suggests that there is it in your mind unusual? You cited that African Americans make up 13% of the population, but account for more than half of those incarcerated.
Yes.
Why did you cite those statistics?
To me, it's insane. You know, it isn't something that I made up, or that I came out of my head. I said, well, this is what it is.
But what does it suggest to you?
You mean as a remedy?
No, as the statistic itself. What do you think might be the reason for it?
Well, you know, I can. You can say there's reasons for it, but my thought is, I know it's hard out here. I'm 71 years old, and I've been through the knocks. I've been to job situations where they actually told you, we don't hire black people. But that didn't induce me to not trying and not encouraging those around me. Yeah, we can make it. It's hard out here. We can make it. I live in like a housing project. And last week there was a big drug bust in our building. They arrested 20 of our young men for selling drug, extorting the people, bullying people. 20 of our young men went away to the criminal and justice system. You know, and that's ridiculous. The homicide rate. When the gentleman got killed over here in Jersey, got choked to death.
There's some Staten Island. You're talking about Eric Garner?
Yeah. About a week before that, a young girl, 8 years, I think she was about 4 years old, she was sitting in her mother's house, and a bullet comes through the wall and kills her. Nobody said anything about it. Nobody. You know, there was no hoopla. How can this happen to our young people? Nobody. But, you know, when police kill one of us, yes, we should raise hell. You know, we should do what we should do. But when a life is taken by our own, from one of our own, then we should raise hell also.
Well, thank you, Mitch. You got the conversation started. Let's see if anybody picks up on what you have contributed today. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Bye. Joel from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrecht. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Do you hear me all right?
Yes.
Oh, good, good. You know, I wanted to, I was thinking a little this morning about the letter that a liberal Zionist Jewish leader from the United States sent to Haaretz that you read.
Don Futterman.
Yeah. What was his name again?
Don Futterman.
Futterman, that's right. And, you know, I was thinking about that in conjunction with Netanyahu's visit to France when he implored the Jews of France and Europe that Israel was not just a place, you know, in whose direction you pray, it's your home. And it immediately brought up to me a memory that I had in my early youth, in my pre-adolescence, I think, when David Ben-Gurion always used to come to New York, and he would be interviewed by gay press on a very famous reporter from New York, still alive, I believe. And the first thing that Ben-Gurion would always say, he'd look right into the camera and tell people to Jewish population of the city to migrate to Israel. So this is not, you know, a new phenomenon. And what I wanted to talk today was the way in which this, because it's connected to Zionism, and the way in which Zionism as a political movement somehow has a connection to something that I thought about this morning, and that is the colonization movement for African Americans in the pre-Civil War South. And, you know, as everybody knows, the Zionist political movement was founded by people like Herzl and Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, and all of them were atheists. And they really regarded the Bible as a book that was extended only as so far as it served their nationalist politics. They looked at the Bible as a kind of ethnic marker, that it indicated a common origin for individuals of very different backgrounds and secular cultures, but it was still predicated on their religion, which they barely observed. And they wanted to, the Zionist aspiration was really about creating a political association that privileged those who shared a kind of imaginary ancestry over people whose land they planned to appropriate. And at first, politicians like Ben-Gurion recognized, as all serious historians today do, that the Palestinians were descendants of Judean peasants themselves, and they had inhabited the land at the time of the Arab conquest. But later, when Palestinians resisted Zionist machinations for a Jewish state during Mandate Palestine, it became apparent that it would be impossible for Zionists to integrate what they saw as an inferior culture into their political scheme. And that caused Ben-Gurion and others to simply ignore this historical knowledge in order to strip the native population of any rights they enjoyed as rightful owners of the land. And they used that to justify their dispossession by militant Zionists. And so this notion, it's now understood, by the way, that European Jews themselves are descendants, for the most part, of the Khazars, who rooted empire in the Transcaucasus of converts to Judaism. And that's where, the large present-day population of Jews in Russia came from. But even if the biblical version of Judaism were true, the idea that a race of people share, immutable similarities that bestow on them rights that aren't accorded to people who don't belong to that group is a racist one. And it distorts the idea of home to be a product of biology rather than an individual experience. When I thought about all of this, and I thought about Netanyahu and Israeli politicians cavalierly calling for Jews across the world to return to their home, that it's a kind of version of manifest destiny in Palestine. And these people believe that Jews should make themselves part of a ruling majority where they can forcibly assert their supremacy. And rather than attempting to improve the social welfare of Jewish people based on their unique circumstances, it seems to me that what Zionism has done is to reduce the identity of Jewish people to the privilege they derive from belonging to an imagined ethnicity. And I see similarities with what happened in the United States in the pre-Civil War period. There, you saw many people who believed that the abolition of slavery should be coupled with the colonization of African Americans, as you well know, in Liberia and Central America and Caribbean and in elsewhere. And the most famous proponent of colonization was Lincoln himself. And Lincoln inherited the idea from his political idea, Henry Clay, who had created the American colonization, sorry, I think it was in 1816. And supporters of colonization of African Americans generally believed that blacks were an inferior race who didn't belong in the U.S. They believed the privilege and power belonged to whites, and blacks threatened to reduce this privilege, so they needed to be eliminated. Just as Zionists see Jews as sharing a common ancestral home, so the African-American colonization proponents see Africa as a home for the blacks. And in fact, Lincoln himself evolved on the topic throughout his career, but he was never an abolitionist. I mean, he opposed slavery as an institution because he believed slaves had a right, to life, liberty, and a right to be paid for their labor, but he never believed in equality between blacks and whites. And even after the start of the Civil War, Lincoln made clear his support for the gradual emancipation of slaves that was tied to colonization. And, not surprisingly, many African Americans opposed this. The famous abolitionist Douglas was very adamant against this sort of thing. And so what I'm saying, in effect, is that both Zionism and white supremacy are guilty of propagating the myth of race as a biologically illegitimate fact when it is nothing more than an artificial social construct. And people who believe in the division of society by race and ethnicity propagate racist ideas that reduce people to classifications that ignore all other aspects of one's social and cultural experience. So while white supremacists sought to expel African Americans to ensure white rule over the U.S., Zionists seek to import Jews to ensure Jewish rule over mandatory Palestine. Zionism, it seems to me, then, shares many of the same goals as American white supremacy of 150 years ago.
All right. Thank you for your contribution today, Joel. Very, very interesting parallels that you have drawn here. From New York, Judy, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And very good afternoon to you.
This is my very first time getting through.
Oh,
but I was hoping I would get through today on Free My Mind, because when I heard the program earlier this week, I told myself that I'm going to keep on trying until I get through, because the topic a few days ago, I really wanted to address, and I think when I one of your callers, you asked her if she had an idea of what to do to put what it is she was professing in place. And I'm believing, I'm saying to you, and to your callers, to your listeners, that I perceive, and I've thought it for a long while, that fear, two places, two ways. Fear, the Caucasian, I'd rather say Caucasian than white. I don't know what the hell that is. That's lack of color, if I understand. And black is inclusive of all colors. It is fear for African, I don't know what word I want to call us now, Africans in America. Let me try it like that. African ancestry persons living in the United States of America were at one time a people, and is still current today in my mind, have all the idea and the knowledge and afraid of by persons who are in power, white supremacy, all of whatever happens to make that happen, know that they are an inferior people. I say it again. They know that they are inferior to a mind of people that do not look like them. And if ever people that look like me, and you know who I am, were to understand that the only thing in my mind that's keeping you, not you, me, back, is that we fear what they will do to us like they did Dr. King and Malcolm.
Now, let me ask you.
Okay.
I want to tackle the word inferior. Why would you use that word?
Well, it's not my word. It's not my word. The great Elton H. Maddox Jr. said that we people of color, my people of color, my word, not his, need to write our own dictionary. The words that is used, that I am using to speak with you and all of your listeners, are not words that I would say to offer what I mean by what I'm saying. These words were given to us. We learned this language that was not ours, that I'm using and saying to get those of us who can understand what I'm saying. I've lost somebody already. But what I'm suggesting is I'm using... Oh, stop laughing. That's funny. I'm suggesting by what I'm saying that me, don't listen. We just don't listen. And when we do, we don't hear. We are easily confused by some people. And I'm running off. I did not really think I was going to get on today. But my thing that I would like the listeners to understand what I'm saying is, my persons, those of mine who came from everywhere, not in something called Europe. I don't know what the hell Europe is. And I don't want to go off on a tangent, but if somebody were to look and find out where the name Europe really came from, there might be a little surprise. Anyhow, if I would not fear, and right now I'm saying I am not, if more of us would say we do not fear, then if we could gather like that, those of us that would say it, we know that somebody will try and get us. We know that's what they have to do. I'm saying that because I believe they know they are inferior. They are an inferior people who don't know anything else but how to survive. You said it a moment ago. Who is it that keeps saying people of color? And people of color are the majority around the planet. I don't know where this white supremacy thing came up, but it's their own survival. It means for them to survive. They have to survive at all costs. So everything, all the means of production, is held by them. Everything that you and I eat, the clothes we wear, the cars we drive, the industry, the fuel, the everything that is needed for life to be on the planet is controlled by people that don't look like you and me, Idris. So that if that is in fact the case, and in the Bible that I was taught, a few of them, that a particular people determine themselves to be God's chosen. What the hell? You decided that you are God's chosen, and you wreak havoc on the planet every single hour of every single day of every single year. And you celebrate a time called Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, Day of Atonement. Ask for forgiveness. And then you continue after that day to wreak the havoc continuing that you did the day before you atoned.
But I have to ask you, why are you singling out a particular group?
Well, I'm talking about more than one group. I'm talking about the group I belong to.
In terms of supremacy.
Well, nobody said, Judy, you are superior to your trees. Nobody ever said anybody that my mother is superior to Andrew Cuomo. Nobody ever said that. I don't think I've never heard it, let me say that. And I've gone to their schools. I got their degrees that they gave. I got me one of those, two of those, three of those. And I had to come out into the real world and see that those degrees that they gave me, that I earned, I could not use in order to facilitate a life of comfort without distress that my children, all themselves, master teachers, my grandsons, will know because their grandmother that they call, refer to as Grandma, has been telling them ever since they came on the planet that you will not work for anybody. We don't say that. As soon as we graduate, we're talking about, I'm going to get a job. No, you're behind me, dude, like J.A. Rogers said. Get a hot dog stand, God dog it. Sell some hot dogs. Sell some lemonade. Everybody else teaches theirs to do that. They don't want theirs working for anybody. They want theirs to give the orders, to give the instruction. They want theirs to know that this is what is due them. They are the ones to instruct and determine and decide. Come up with all the ideas. And then make the staff, usually some of them, put it in place. Make it happen.
Well, you've told us quite a bit today. And again, this is what this forum is for people to express themselves. We will see how people react to what you offer today, Judy. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
And congratulations for getting through. I'm glad about that. From New York. New York is kind of heavy today. What's going on? Is there no other state in this country? Allie from New York, you're on the air.
Yeah, so I saw the same thing too today. But I just wanted to say hello to the PRN audience, and I have two things today that I would like to get a chance to say, because, wow, Judy said a lot. And I would like to comment on her and also Joel, but I can't because I have my two things that I would like to put out there. The first thing that I wanted to say is that on January 22nd, that was on a Thursday, we went to Staten Island to support Ransom Orta, and I just wanted to tell you, you trees, that it was like the Miss Leeds meetup. I just wanted to say that Michael Gray asked me to say a few words, and you had to see these three ladies that came to me, and they said, "You must be Ali, that the lady who calls on you trees Leeds," and I said, "Yes." So I just wanted to tell you that when you come over to New York one of these days, I will even be responsible for maybe arrange that we could go out with some of those ladies if they listen to maybe a breakfast or lunch or something. I'm sorry that I couldn't attend Dr. Clark's event, but I just wanted to say that out there to all these people in New York, because it was very, very funny when these ladies came to me. I was really shocked. But that is one thing. And the second thing I just wanted to make comment on what you said on Wednesday. I listened to your Wednesday show when you were talking about what happened here in New York City. And last night I actually downloaded the first part because I wanted my husband to hear what you had to say, because it was almost word by word what I told him during that time, especially when it came to martial law, because he was drinking the Kool-Aid like the rest of the people in this city.
Be kind to your husband now, Allie.
No, I have to say it because I told her, I said, you have to listen to her, especially when she was talking about the martial law, and he did indeed listen to that, to the program. I just wanted to say that, yes, I thought it was martial law. And the reason that I compare it, that I was telling him, was because something happened during Sandy here, and also I was thinking about what they did in Boston. And I'm wondering why the government doesn't want the citizens of this city to see what they will do it. They not only will make people very fearful of something. We don't know about what. Because right from the beginning during the day, I knew there was not a snow coming the way that they were professing on TV. I mean, you can tell. The sun came out. It wasn't really that dark. And all these things, all these indications, to me, I don't think what they were saying would be happening. And I actually thought it was martial law. What they were doing, I have no idea, because the city was deserted. You didn't see. We live in an avenue, and our apartment faced that avenue. There was no one on the street, not even a car. So, I agree with you. I'm thinking about how Cuomo took over the city, and he didn't let de Blasio be in charge, because I don't know if you remember that in Buffalo, they had such a big storm, a snowstorm. I think it was either last month or in December, and he didn't stop Buffalo. He didn't set up martial law in Buffalo. As a matter of fact, he even looked bad in what happened in Buffalo, because some people even died in Buffalo. So I was wondering the difference between Buffalo and New York City. How come he came and he stopped the subway? I had never seen. The only time that the subway had been stopped in this city had been when they had a strike or the blackout, because no electricity. That was, to me, it was just an incredible thing about stopping. There were two people who called me the next day that they got stranded at their job. One young man that I know, who is part of one of the group that I belong, he works in the Kennedy Airport. He called me to tell me that he was still there at 2 o'clock the next day. And this is something, I'm just wondering what this, and during Sandy, my son went down below 34th Street at the Lower East Side. And at that time, there was no electricity. And my son said that the only thing that you could see down in the Lower East Side was the army roaming around, a lot of army trucks in the city. And he said it looks like a war zone. And my son never had been in the war. So, but he saw so many soldiers in trucks during Sandy that he was actually afraid. So this is something that I just wanted to throw it out there so the audience will know what is happening, because something is happening that people are not aware. It's like the police department in this city, the way that they're acting toward us, toward black and brown people, and this thing with this martial law. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling. I thought about that, and especially because there was that forecast by the National Weather Service, but there were other forecasts that said they doubted that there was any snow coming. But just the same, the governor decided that there was only one authority on the matter. Thanks so much for calling. From Texas, we have Sarah.
Greetings to you, Utrice.
Thank you, Sarah, and to you too.
Yes, ma'am, and greetings to the PRN audience, because y'all were kind of East Coast heavy there for a minute. So I was...
and New York specifically.
Yes, exactly, one specific state, and it's nice hearing all the calls and callers, and Ali is very famous because they quoted her in the News One article in reference to them, to Attorney Maddox with the Ramsey Order case. I don't know if she had a chance to read the online publication, but she was quoted in that piece that News One wrote up on her. Also, you treated to tag back to your first caller, and he was making in reference to mass incarceration, and to me it sounded as if though he was trying to blame the victim, as if though we are responsible for incarceration. And I take issues with that because...
But I didn't get that at all. I got that he was citing this as a symptom of a problem that really needs to be talked about and examined very closely. I didn't think he was laying blame there.
Well, for me, what I was getting from him is that he in a way is laying blame weighted more on the side, because he's quoting statistics as though it is actual evidence, and then he made reference to this roundup that they had at a complex where these people were picked up. I'm not saying that drugs and violence does not happen in our community, but when you are seeing it so weighted so heavily in one particular corner, as it was, because you don't really know what exactly happened. When cops come in and swoop down and they picked up all of these people, it's a means of intimidation, because they're like picking fruit from low-hanging limbs, as I would like to term it. Because whoever is easy to pick on and bully, that's what they're going to do. They're not going to go up into Westchester and all of these highfalutin areas where people are doing coke and they're bringing it in. They have the planes, the boats, and they're bringing it in. And they know it's in that area, but they're not going to do that because they know what the backlash is going to be if they weren't going to raid one of those very wealthy, affluent areas like out in the Hamptons and those other places. It's not going to go over very well. So they're going to have this heavy presence in the black area, and if you want to find something wrong, you're going to find it wrong, because that is your intention, is to come out there to find something wrong. And so let's not say that those people who got swooped up, that they're guilty of a crime. All they're guilty of is perhaps being in a particular area when these people wanted to make their drug bust to get their numbers up or whatever it is that they needed to get up, that they happened to be there, and then some people in that group could have been doing illegal activities, and they all got rounded up, and they're going to sort it out, because any which way to look at it, they got their numbers, these people are going to have to post bail, they're registered in the system, and then now they move on to another location. So we have got to be very cognizant of that, and I think that everyone is guilty of something, because you see a cop on the side of the road, and they're frisking them, that perhaps they did something bad. But to get back quickly to what I want to free my mind on, and Joel kind of touched on it a little bit with everything with what's going on in Israel and this heightened, and to me, I don't know if you had a chance to look at the 60 Minute piece. I think it was either last Sunday or the Sunday before, where they interviewed John Boehner as well as Mitch McConnell, and they were asking them about what their stance were on different bills, you know, as well as to raise the tax on the wealthy and everything. And everything they were saying, no, 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 we're not intending to do anything as far as the president is concerned, anything that would relieve the suffering on the masses. And then, of course, this situation with Netanyahu coming here to address the joint session, which to me I find offensive. Now, you see, it comes back to what I was said earlier in previous calls, you three said. Here it is that you have somebody who's a sitting head of state for another foreign nation. He has dual citizenship from the U.S. as well as in Israel. And now he is coming here. They're bringing a foreign leader to sit in on a joint session that covers domestic as well as foreign policy to have him influence them or put input onto what the U.S. policy is. They're making it seem once again that U.S. foreign policy is Israel's foreign policy. They're convoluting the two because this is highly inappropriate. And if the people are sitting back and they're seeing this, because this is very seditious, this is very traitorous, this is treasonous, because these are things that you know, it are bordering on espionage, because you're having a foreign leader to come into your session and make dictates to you. And it's inappropriate. And I'm not hearing any outbursts. I'm not hearing anyone saying anything that they need to resend that invitation. Tell them that no, you cannot come here, because not only is it a slap in the face to the White House and the office of the presidency that is occupied by an African American and where this slight is being thrown at, even though this man has done so much for Israel, more than any other administration, as well as far as policies and funding and everything he has given to them, but it's just not enough. And not only that, is that, you know, as Joel mentioned, is when they went to Paris for this terrorist attack that they said took place, is he's going to make this invitation, whoever wants to come to Israel for their homeland, we give you an open invitation, you could come. Now, to me, whose land are you going to take now in order to give these people home? You're inviting somebody else to come into my home. You, Treese, you out there in New York, you're going to invite some friends and say, okay, I'm going to send you to Texas and you can stay with Sarah without even consulting Sarah. Because that's what they're doing. They're telling these people, we're going to give you a place. Now they're trying to push some more Palestinians off their land, encroach some more, build more illegal settlements, which they have not stopped building, in order to bring more people to come in. This is the type of things that they keep doing. This Congress, the UN, everyone else has been turning a blind eye and let Israel continue to do it, because they're the ones who are responsible for some of the animals that is going on in that particular region, because they want to be the only nuclear power in that area, and they don't want anyone else to have a means of defending themselves, as they're saying they're entitled to do to defend themselves on occupied territory. That's the height of the hypocrisy, that you came and you took somebody else's land, and you're there, but you're telling the other surrounding countries that they don't have that right to have the same level of defense that you have for yourself.
Well, this is, this really was so offensive on so many levels, because number one, as I said, Netanyahu was asked by President Hollande of France not to come.
Yes.
Because it would have aggravated a situation. And the situation it would have aggravated has to do with the problem that France itself is facing with the exodus of many, many Jews. As many as 7,500 already have left. And many of them do not want to go to Israel, as a matter of fact. So when Netanyahu comes in the aftermath of the killing of, I think, four Jewish people at the deli by these gunmen. And he makes it, of course, he's running for office again, and he makes it an issue of, well, if they don't like you here, then you come home. This is what offended France, that he was essentially saying that you are not safe in this country. And it was repugnant to the French. So he won absolutely no friends there. For one, deciding, of course, his very presence just aggravated the situation and put France on in a bad way, because now they had to rustle up extra security just because he was there.
Exactly. And that's the same reason to why the president did not go, because we all know that when this president have to travel, the Secret Service have to get advance notice to set up all the security parameters and all of those things before the president can travel out and go to a location. It was not adequate time for him to do that. So that is one of many reasons why he probably did not even show up there.
But now Netanyahu, combining with Boehner, is now operating at another level of repugnance,
exactly,
which has to do with just blatant racism.
And
it's not being said publicly, of course. They're saying, well, you know, on a diplomatic level and on a constitutional level, they're raising these questions. But I'm saying that what this act is communicating, and people should not miss it, is that it is their version of boy. We're going to put you in your place.
Yes,
and
exactly,
directed at this African-American president to say, since you're so stupid that you don't know how important it is to contain Iran, we're going to bring somebody in your house to tell you because you're not well-schooled. So we're going to import a teacher. And that had that same it reverberated with the same resonance of the Southern confrontations, where people would call a man, even a president, boy. And that's
exactly
pretty much what this said to me. And it is alarming in a sense that people are just running around the subject, but that's really what it is. This man is such, I'm talking about Netanyahu, is so absolutely without any modicum of just plain good manners.
There's no decency involved in this, Utrice. And Congressional Black Caucus, which goes to show you how they're all bought and sold for, because you don't hear none of them coming out protesting, saying, okay, this is disrespectful. This should not happen. We are not on board with this. We need to go ahead and resend this invitation. He's using this as a political stump speech. That's what he is doing. And he's also showing, flexing his muscle to show who really controls this Congress. It's
exactly
the AIPAC and all of these other lobbying agencies that's funded by them that really controls them.
Well, this is what Don Futterman's article was about that I had read earlier this week. He's saying, I mean, just on a tactical level, you're really cutting off your nose to spite your own face. And you really need to revise this. But it shows the racism of Boehner. It shows the fact that Israel and the lobby, we talked about that here, the AIPAC, they have extraordinary influence in Congress. They're operating literally as a lobbying group for a foreign country, and that needs to be addressed. And
exactly,
they did not have any problem saying it's posted on their website that two-thirds of Congress will be expected to show up at their convention,
exactly,
which is going to be held just at the time that Netanyahu is going to be addressing the joint session. So it tells you that there are huge problems that everybody is agreeing one way or the other to avoid. They're just, we're not going to touch this.
Well, Utrice, I'm going to say this and get off. This, like I said before, this is showing who's in charge of that Congress, which is why Cynthia McKinney, the former Congresswoman from my old 4th district, this is why she was on that stump, and she was telling us years ago what goes on with this PAC and this pledge that you must sign. Now you can really see who has signed those pledges and those PACs, why it is that they say if three-quarters of y'all got to show up, and they know if they don't show up, they're going to run alternate candidates like they did with Gus Savage, Cynthia, and quite a few other people who they put out of office because they were unruly and they can't control them.
Well, thank you for your call, Sarah.
You're welcome.
Always a lot to think about. From Los Angeles, just because we have to balance the East Coast, West Coast kind of thing, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice. How are you?
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, just like Sarah, I was starting to think it was going to be an all East Coast show today. So happy to chime in from the West Coast. I want to say hello to all the listeners today, all my progressive brothers and sisters. And I originally had called in to talk about this phony State of the Union speech that was given by Mr. Commander-in-Chief. But your first caller and then Sarah right before me, they wrote me in. I got to take the bait. I got to talk about this situation with the prisons. I think we have to remember a couple of things. The fact that there are, you know, 60 to 65% African-Americans in the prisons is no accident. And this does stem back to the, I believe, back to Richard Nixon and his war on drugs, and it's gotten steadily worse and worse with every administration since then. And this is, now it's become pretty much prisons for profit, and it's basically the modern-day slavery is what it is. These guys in prison, they work for $1, $2 an hour, you know, and some of them doing very hard manual labor. And I think we have to, first of all, realize that, and there's a few ways we can attack this problem, because it is a very, very serious problem in our inner-city communities, both black and Hispanic. I think one of the things we have to do is we have to get rid of these clowns in city government and in these mayoral positions around the country who are not representing our interests. If they're supposed to represent our inner cities and they're not representing our interests, we need to get rid of these clowns, stop believing their lies, and stop putting them in office. That's the first thing we need to do, because you pointed out that problem in New York of how, you know, the city council and the other people have control over the, should have control over the police, but they really don't. So that's one thing we can do. The other thing we need to do is fellowship in our own communities to young people and advising them not to get caught into the trap that's out there for them, traps, I should say, with an S. When I was young, I was kind of a wild child, and I got in a few little scrapes and things with trouble, and luckily I had a mother who was there for me and talked to me, and I didn't end up getting in any serious trouble. But I think we have to change our frame of mind on a lot of these things. People think that, a lot of people think that if someone is arrested, they're naturally guilty of something. And this is the thing. When someone gets arrested, supposedly in this country, they're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. But we get it drummed into our head from TV shows and all the propaganda that's out there, and the schooling that's out there, which sucks in our communities, that if someone gets arrested, then they're a bad person or this type of thing. And I think a lot of people who have not been through that don't really understand the whole thing. And another thing about the first caller that called, the other statistics he left out was that not only are most of these people who are in prison black, but most people are in prison for nonviolent offenses, mainly drugs, right? And that goes back to the war on drugs, and that's why so many of us in there from our communities. So I think we have to kind of go back to the drawing board. I do a little fellowship in my own community. There's a Boys and Girls Club in my neighborhood. And I was just over there one day with my son shooting basketball with him and a few other of his little friends. And I started talking to them and telling them some of the experiences I had been through and answering some of their questions, because they had a lot of questions about this type of stuff. And I look up and the associate director is right there at the door, and she was very intrigued, and she asked me to come to her office, and she said she asked me to come back about 2 weeks later and talk to a larger group of children about these issues. So there's something all of us can do, and I would suggest that that's where we need to start right there.
Well, thank you. But, you know, it's a very, very complex situation, and yes, one that, if you know, you take a historical view, you begin to ask other kinds of questions. There was a time when there were no African-American prisoners at all.
Right.
And then we find that now African-Americans and Latinos in particular, these two groups, are basically the cannon fodder for a multi-billion dollar system. Now, you have to ask yourself a question. What was the rationale for Mario Cuomo, the father of the current governor of the state of New York, to build 30 prisons? Now, on what basis was that decision made? And he built 30 prisons. All right. It must be because there was a plan somehow that these prisons, once built, will be filled. And they are hubs, economic hubs of communities. Entire communities upstate New York live on the fact that so many people are incarcerated. And we had the late Eddie Ellis, who himself was incarcerated. He did a phenomenal study showing that the vast majority of the people in the prisons and jails of New York State come from seven distinct neighborhoods. So, you know, when you start talking about how complex this all is, you see that there is a plan. There are lots of plans being made and predicated
Absolutely. We're talking about big money here. This is
sure.
big money. It's not only that, and it's also wielding political power, too. And that's the reason so many of these states are leaning to the right when they really shouldn't be, is because they count these prisoners in most states as the population of where the prison is instead of from where they live originally, right? So when they have these massive prison populations in upstate New York, that adds to their population and gets them more representation as well.
Well, yes, but you also have this question about national policy, domestic policy, as if people don't know that there's a correlation between rotten education and dropout rates and crime.
Absolutely.
By those people who drop out. You have unemployment. The president stood before the nation on January the 20th and said, you know, unemployment is down, greatly down, and things are. But when you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they tell you the same story. The unemployment rate for African Americans and Latinos is more than twice that of whites in this country. They're not. These are the kinds of duplicities that are occurring, and we know that this is a huge and all-encompassing problem. It's not just one-dimensional. It runs
right.
the gamut. So unless
and what you've touched
we
touched on there is the fact that education in our schools is tied to property taxes and income in these communities, and if there's no jobs in the communities and people are struggling, there's not going to be the schools are not going to be healthy, in other words. They're not going to have the funding.
We still cannot discount the fact and the role that even law enforcement plays in crime. And I've talked about the case of Larry Davis, Adam Abdul Hakim, who as a teenager was recruited by the cops in the Bronx to sell drugs, to run a prostitution ring, to sell guns. And he was not even 14. We know the case of Los Angeles, flooding the entire neighborhood with cocaine. And the person who was at the heart of that is walking around with, you know, as a great patriot today. So we have all of these things to throw into the hopper when we take a look at a problem. And we see that it is multidimensional. And as multidimensional as it is, it nonetheless is predicated on the racist, white supremacist view that there is a population that is perfectly discardable.
Well, and they're disposable.
How can we use this population to advance all these other interests that we have?
Right, and it goes to what Sarah commented, that they pick on the weak and the vulnerable communities, and they know that this is a gold mine for them. So all they got to do is keep digging into these communities and putting these young boys in prison, and it's big profit is what it is, and it's really a shame. So but what we've done over the last 30, 40 years, we haven't really been active to do anything about it, and we need to activate and cut this nonsense out because it's really depleting our neighborhoods. You got more and more young fathers going to jail and things like that, getting shot and all this other stuff. We need to get a handle on this.
Yes, we do. Absolutely. Because actually, as Martin Luther King warned, the ultimate goal of racism / white supremacy is genocide. And we're
Absolutely.
Headed in that direction from all indications. That's really what it
Absolutely.
Looks like. Thanks so much,
Absolutely.
GX, for your call. And thank
Have
you all for
weekend,
your
Patrice.
Extraordinary calls today. I like the idea that at this forum, we speak our minds responsibly, and people should take into consideration that what is being offered is the sincere thought of individuals, the sincere thinking. And these are the kinds of conversations we ought to be able to have with each other, not in a spirit of fear or, you know, just out-and-out hatred or anything like that, but it is people saying, this is my reality. This is the reality we're living with. And it is valid in that sense. So we should have the courage to deal with each other where we are. And this is what I think is so extraordinary about the exchanges that we have on this program. And I want to thank you so much for responsibly advancing your thoughts and defending your position. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much also for the mutual respect that you continue to show, and you keep the program at a very high level. I like that, and I really am grateful for that. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com via email and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Have yourselves a great weekend. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.